Welcome to the Book Nook on WYSO, and I'd like to welcome to the program today Mitchell Zuckoff. He's written a book that was a really big bestseller last year in hardcover. It's just come out in paperback. It's called Lost in Shangri-La, a true story of survival, adventure, and the most incredible rescue mission of World War II. Welcome to the program, Mitch.
Thanks very much for having me, Vic.
Mitch, this is an amazing story, and this book never would have happened if you hadn't been working on a completely different story, and you kind of stumbled upon this one, didn't you?
That's a perfect way to put it. I stumbled upon. This was just one of those sort of really fortunate things that happens sometimes, a little bit of kismet. I was researching another book that wasn't ever going to be written. It just wasn't really a book. I thought it might be, but it wasn't. And I came across a headline in the Chicago Tribune from 1945, Glider Rescue in Shangri-La Delayed by Clouds. And I didn't have to be very bright at that moment to know that anything in that story was better than what I was working on, and I should check it out.
And what did you find?
Well, in this story, this was just so incredible that it was completely lost to history. It was one of those things that fell through the cracks, and it was in that first story. A plane crash in New Guinea in 1945, near the end of World War II. 24 people who had gone on a plane called the Gremlin Special, a sightseeing trip, really, for these people, these hardworking men and women who were members of the Women's Army Corps, who were based in New Guinea, who wanted to see this valley, who wanted just to have a little bit of R&R, a little rest and relaxation during the war effort. This valley had been discovered a year earlier by the Army, and where their maps said there would be mountains, instead was this incredible verdant valley in the middle of the island of New Guinea. And even more incredible was that it was inhabited by tens of thousands of people for whom the Stone Age had never ended. These were people who hadn't discovered the wheel, who hadn't discovered textiles. The men were naked except for gourds covering their genitals. The women just wore kind of a wrapped piece of twine around their hips. And so it became kind of a sensation. All the people who were stationed on New Guinea were hoping to be able to fly over it. You couldn't land in the valley. It was surrounded by mountains. There was no place to land. But they thought, wow, if I could just see this place, I would have a story to tell when I get home from the war. And so it became kind of a reward for people who were hardworking in this Hollandia, New Guinea, in this base called Base G near the end of the war. And this colonel, who was looking to reward the men and women who he worked with, set up this trip. It was Mother's Day, May 13th, 1945, and he invited along himself and 23 others, and they were going to have a three-hour tour, if you will, just a quick overflight to see these villages, to see these people who were reported, in fact, correctly reported, to be cannibals, and who raised pigs and sweet potatoes and fought endless tribal wars with sticks and stones and spears and arrows. Tragically, though, and again, all this was in that first story, which I couldn't believe, tragically, the plane crashed on the way into the valley. And I explain in the book all the circumstances of how and why it crashed. And left alone in this jungle at the edge of this valley were these three people, one of whom, as it turns out, spent much of his life living there in Dayton, John McCullum, who really emerges, I think, as a tremendous hero of this story. He had gotten on the plane with his brother, Robert McCullum. They were inseparable twins. They were known, in fact, as the Inseparables. And Robert and John had to be separated only because they were the last two to board this plane. Robert found a seat near the front, near the cockpit. John found a seat near the tail. And that was enough. That 20-foot separation ended up separating them forever. Robert didn't emerge from the plane. John emerges in the jungle, unhurt, but basically having suffered an existential wound. And then with him, our young sergeant named Ken Decker, who was terribly burned and has a head injury. He remembers nothing of the flight, nothing of the crash. And Margaret Hastings, a beautiful member of the Women's Army Corps, and who's burned, who's barefoot, her shoes had either been blown off or burned off in the crash, and she has to decide to wear the shoes of her best friend to survive in this jungle. And that's kind of the basic outline that was all laid out for me there, that here was this untold story of remarkable endurance, of survival, of wherewithal, and of tremendous courage in the jungle of New Guinea near the end of World War II.
The book is Lost in Shangri-La. Mitchell Zuckoff wrote it, and he joins us on the program today. And everything seems so incredibly random, the fact that they decided to fly that day, the fact that the twin brothers got on last and were separated, but there was nothing really random about it. That's just the way it transpired. And then there's the thing where the pilot decides to get up and walk back onto the plane, and he lets someone else less experienced fly the plane, and that really was part of the problem, wasn't it?
Very much so, Vic. Colonel Peter Prossen was a bit of arrogance. I think he was a good man, and I've sort of got to know him through his letters home and through his children and some people who flew with him who I met later. But he made a terrible mistake. It was tragic because this is treacherous flying conditions. On the way into this valley, there are updrafts and downdrafts. Other pilots who had been through it warned of these. And yet, at just the wrong time, Peter Prossen leaves the cockpit, and not for a bad reason. He wanted to socialize. This was supposed to be a morale-building flight, and he had hoped to socialize with the men and women who had worked with him. But he left behind this Major Nicholson, this less experienced pilot, who clearly was ill-equipped to handle this kind of treacherous flying. And I try not to be too hard on Peter Prossen because, although certainly it cost 20 lives, but it also cost his life, and so he paid for this mistake in the ultimate way.
If you had stumbled upon this newspaper clipping in that Chicago paper, say 5 years later, could you still have written the book?
I fear not. I this is just so much of the great fortune of this. One of my most important sources has been a man named Earl Walter, who was the chief rescuer. He was a paratrooper, part of a team who, after the survivors found themselves there in the valley, Earl parachuted in with 10 Filipino-American paratroopers to save, to rescue, to protect them until the Army could figure out how to get them out of this valley. And Earl, thankfully, is still alive. He's 91, but just in, for instance, the 5 years since we first started talking, Earl's memory is not what it once was. I don't know. I don't know if I could have gotten half the amazing material I got from Earl. And one after another, I think, Vic, as you know, we're losing the members of the Greatest Generation at a terrible clip. And so many of the people who were almost, it almost was like they were waiting for me to call. One of my wonderful sources was the widow of John McCollum, B.B. McCollum, who lives there in your community. And B.B., thankfully, is still alive. I hope to be seeing her in the next couple of weeks, in fact. And, B.B. was incredible because she handed me John's scrapbook, and she handed me this trove of photographs that had been taken in the valley. And I hope B.B. is around forever, but let's face it, none of us will be. So I feel like it was a great bit of good fortune that I found the story when I did.
It was B.B. who sent me an email last year to let me know about this book when it came out in hardcover, and I wrote a review of it for the Dayton Daily News and the Springfield News Sun. And it was also B.B. who sent me another email to tell me that you were going to be in Dayton for a book signing, and
yes,
this is a big deal. This is Monday night at 7 o'clock, May 14th, at Books & Company at the Green, and I think there's going to be a large turnout for this. You might want to show up early, because John McCollum was a civilian employee for many years at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, and I understand that he worked on projects like the Air Force One jets that flew John F. Kennedy and Richard Nixon, isn't that right?
That's correct. And in fact, I thank you for mentioning this, Vic. I'm looking forward to this event very, very much. I think it's going to be a really fun event on the 14th. But even more exciting, I think, than meeting me, that B.B. herself will be there. And she's she's a much more interesting character.
And you're probably aware of this, but I just got an email from my editor this morning that had been forwarded to me from John McCollum's stepdaughter, Jane Duser, in London, England, and she is coming in for the book signing as well.
I was blown away when I heard that. And it's funny, my first contact, I think, when I reached out to try and find the McCollum family years ago, was through Jane in London, where she's a very successful businesswoman. And Jane put me on, and Jane, I think, kind of vetted me and made sure that I was who I said I was, and I was going to do what I said I would do. And so she connected me to BB. So I think to all be together, I'm very excited about that.
And she has a cousin who is the daughter of John's twin brother who was killed in the crash. And her cousin was 2 months old when that crash occurred. And her name is Denise McCollum Scott. And she lives in Minneapolis. And she's also coming to the event.
Yes, she is. In fact, Denise is known colloquially, most of us know her as Denny. And Denny has also embraced me and the book Lost in Shangri-La. And I think readers and I think people who come and visit with us on Monday night, to have those two especially, to have Denny and BB, who are so connected, so deeply connected to this story, it brings it home. I mean, there's something I think special that you and I have talked about before, Vic, about nonfiction. As much as I admire and enjoy fiction, when you're talking about real people who are put into extraordinary circumstances, and if you are fortunate enough to meet the people themselves or the people connected to them, it reminds us, I think, of the strength of humanity, of the strength of individuals, sometimes in inhumane conditions. And so this is, I think, going to be a real treat.
Mitchell Zuckoff joins us. His book, Lost in Shangri-La, just came out in paperback. Okay, so we have this horrendous crash into a mountainside, and there really were four people that came out of the crash, but one of the survivors was a woman who was so badly hurt that she died before they could even get down the mountainside.
That's correct.
Now, is she the one who had the shoes that Margaret wanted?
She was one of the two WACs who briefly was alive, yes.
Okay.
Who Margaret ultimately took the shoes, yes.
So they go down into the valley, which is just an amazingly treacherous trip down a mountainside because two of them are very badly hurt. And they get down into the valley where they encounter these Stone Age tribes. And you went to New Guinea and had the good fortune of meeting someone who was able to help you communicate with some of the surviving members of that tribe who were actually there when the crash occurred. What an amazing story.
Again, it was a tremendous piece of good fortune. These people in the valley today is called the Baliem Valley of New Guinea. It's on the Indonesian side of New Guinea. And there are about 12 people probably on the planet, I'm not exaggerating, who speak English and the native tongue, Dani, the tribal language. And so I was fortunate enough to link up with one who is the son of American missionaries, and his name is Buzz Maxey. And Buzz was able to take me around the valley for a couple of weeks and go from village to village, and they still live, many of them, in very, very traditional thatched-roofed villages, growing still pigs and sweet potatoes. And with Buzz's help, I was able to get the other side of the story. And I had spent several years collecting all the American version of events, declassified documents, things like the photographs from BB and the stories and Earl's story. But in my other life, I'm a professor of journalism at Boston University. And the first rule of journalism is you try to get all sides of the story. And so for me to be able to go into New Guinea and meet with these people, one after another, these old men and women, who, of course, still remembered all the details. It was like the day the Martians landed for them. And so one after another, they told me the story from their perspective. And sometimes, and frequently, they described the same basic events, that this happened or that happened, but from a completely different perspective and a completely different experience and a different understanding in their mind what was happening. And so one of the very fun parts I thought of the book was the ability to for instance, give Earl Walters' version of when he and the paratroopers drop into the valley and they're suddenly surrounded by thousands or hundreds at least of Stone Age tribesmen, and they're really, it's a standoff. Earl and his men have their guns, and these men from the tribes have their spears pointing at them. And so I knew what Earl thought was happening, but then I was able to get from the tribespeople what they thought was happening. And only then could I learn, for instance, that they thought this was the fulfillment of their tribal prophecy. They had a prophecy that said someday light-skinned ghosts or spirits would come down a rope from the sky. And that's one of the reasons why they didn't attack these Americans, these outsiders, immediately. Now, Earl knows the details from his perspective, and he's known them for now 70 years. But he didn't know that. And so one of the really exciting parts for me about telling Lost in Shangri-La was the ability to take the different perspectives and all the different points of view and put them together into one story.
Mitchell Zuckoff wrote it. The book is Lost in Shangri-La. It just came out in paperback. And you also have a background as an investigative journalist. And this book really reads like an old-fashioned newspaper serial. We've got these chapters that end with this kind of cliffhanger, some of them.
It was very much, thank you, Vic. It was really what I was trying to do. I think that, you know, nonfiction doesn't have to be the history books perhaps you and I read when we were in high school. This is a story, and history is a story. My father was a history teacher, and he would tell me stories about events, whether it was World War II or the Civil War or the Revolutionary War, which was his favorite. And I understood back then that if you could tell it like a story and understand the humans, you know, sort of the human emotions involved and the human motivations involved, you could understand the larger forces at work around it. And so when I became a newspaper man, a newspaper reporter, that's what I was trying to do, was to tell little tiny, tiny bits of history, one story at a time. And then as I progressed and became an investigative reporter and then now a professor and an author, that's the same goal. I just tell them at sort of different lengths. And now the idea of telling a book-length version of a story and not, giving people just the vegetables on their plate that they should eat, but also making it a little bit like dessert.
Mm. Well, it really reads like a thriller. And here we have this plane crash, and back at the base, they're saying, what happened? Where did they go? And finally, they establish contact. They realize that there are some survivors in this remote and inaccessible valley. They can't send in a helicopter to get them. They can't fly a plane to get them. They can't hover above and drop down a rope. What are they going to do? And then you start having really interesting people drop in.
Hmm.
And one of them is a guy named Alex Khan, but the key guys were two medics from the Philippines.
Yes. Doc and Rami. These two Filipino-American medics who were even at the time were tremendously overlooked, and I tried to correct that very much in the book. These two men were incredibly brave. They jumped into they parachuted into the middle of a jungle, not knowing what they would encounter, and then just dedicated themselves for weeks to helping Margaret and John Decker and Ken Decker survive and not lose their limbs to gangrene and to deal with their burns. And there's no question that that Ken Decker and Margaret Hastings owe at least their limbs and possibly their lives to these two brave medics. One after another, people start dropping in. and Alex Khan, this crazy filmmaker, and the film is on my website if people want to see it. And it just becomes this sort of bizarre moment. And maybe, as far as I'm concerned, the most bizarre thing is how the army finally decide to try and get them out.
Well, should we leave that mystery for readers? Because it really is kind of an amazing thing.
How about we give them a little hint?
Okay.
Because we do call it the most amazing rescue mission of World War II. Well, imagine, dear listeners, of dropping gliders into a valley, setting up a football goalpost, stringing what's effectively a rubber band across that goalpost, and attaching the other end of the rubber band to the nose of the glider, and then deciding, if this works, we're going to have planes sweep into the valley 15 feet off the valley floor with hooks on their bellies to snatch that rubber band off the top of the goalpost and pull a glider up over the surrounding mountains and back to civilization. And that we'll leave it there, but that becomes, which it's almost strange to use the phrase, that becomes the rescue plan.
Well, I'm getting chills just hearing your buildup. So, and I knew what happened. So I'm guessing our listeners out there are going, whoa. The book is Lost in Shangri-La. Mitchell Zuckoff wrote it, a true story of survival, adventure, and the most incredible rescue mission of World War II. And Mitch is actually going to be in town on Monday, May 14th at 7 o'clock. He'll be at Books & Company at the Green for a book signing, and probably be a pretty big turnout, so you might want to come early for that. The book was a big hit in hardcover, a big seller. Were you surprised?
I have to admit I was. I was honored to tell this story, and this isn't my first book. And there's an old line among authors that writing a book is like wearing a blue suit and wetting your pants. It gives you a warm feeling, and nobody notices. And I had resigned myself to the possibility that that's just how it was going to be. And I was satisfied with the work I had done. I was thrilled with the people I had met, BB and Denny and the whole, all the families. And then the fact that, that somebody noticed that my pants were wet, I guess, was just a huge thrill and a great added bonus.
And this really involved a lot of sleuthing because you traveled around. You went up to New York State where you were able to find Margaret's journal. And that was key. You also came upon a stash of photos that were supposed to be destroyed. Isn't that correct?
That's exactly right, Vic. This is remarkable, and certainly finding Margaret's diary and her journal was up in this little historical society in New York, in upstate New York, was incredible. And then one person put me on to somebody else, and this is how it works in journalism, investigative reporting. You know, one person leads you to another, to another, to another, and finally one led me to Gene Hoops, who was a young private in the Philippines at the end of the war, and his job was to destroy all the materials left behind after the war so it wouldn't ever be useful to if any enemies came into New Guinea. And he was burning material and, you know, doing all his job, and then he came across these photographs from immediately after the crash of the wreckage of the Gremlin Special and even of some of a couple of the bodies of the people who were not incinerated in the crash, but thrown clear. And Gene, to his credit, understood there was some value there, and he would never exploit it, and he wasn't looking for money. He just sort of knew that there was a historical meaning in these photos, and he put them away. And when I reached him, it took him a little, because he had been holding these now for over 60 years, it took me a little time to convince him that he could trust me, and then when he finally did, I was able to include them in the book. And from what readers have told me, they really appreciated just how real it made it, that you're seeing the actual wreckage of the plane. And so people, I can't say enough, Vic, how incredible people were in terms of their generosity in telling this story. People wanted this story told. They knew there was some value there. And I was very grateful they trusted me with it.
I must say, I was really impressed. There's so many astonishing photos in this book. And when you got to New Guinea and you got up on that mountainside and you stood at the crash site and there was still wreckage there, how did you feel at that moment?
Wow, that was probably the most emotional moment of this entire process. I had spent years thinking about and learning about these 24 people on this plane, 21 of whom never really left that mountain, left that place. And when I was there at the top of the mountain and I'm holding a piece of wreckage and there's a piece of the fuselage still there where it's effectively a window. You can see it was a window opening. The glass is long gone. But I had this moment where I imagined that perhaps one of these people who I had come to know and care about, one of the last things they may have done was to look out that very window. That made it more real to me than anything else at that point, because I was there, and I knew they had been there. And so I've been doing this work for a long time, and you become a little bit inured to it. But I had to sort of sit down for a minute and on a rock and just kind of compose myself and realize just what had been entrusted to me, to tell their story, to not leave them there on the mountain, but to come back and tell this story and tell it honestly and tell it well.
John McCollum's widow, Bebe McCollum, still lives here in Dayton. How important was she to this project?
She was crucial to this project. It was so important to me that that Bebe, who is just an extremely bright woman and just a lovely woman, that she believed in me and believed in this project and was willing to trust me with this just truly invaluable, irreplaceable stash of material that John had left behind after his death. And when she trusted me with that, I think that was one of those sort of key moments when you know this will be a book. And then when I showed her the manuscript, and I don't want to speak for her, but she was very, very pleased with the results and felt as though this captured the man she loved and the man she knew, that's when I knew it was ready. So I can't say enough about how important Bebe McCollum was and is to this project.
My guest has been Mitchell Zuckoff. His book, Lost in Shangri-La, A True Story of Survival, Adventure, and the Most Incredible Rescue Mission of World War II, has just come out in paperback. You can meet him Monday night, May 14th at 7 o'clock for a book signing at the Green, the Books and Company store there in Beaver Creek. And this is going to be a very special night. Some of John McCollum's family members are going to be there. And just a really, really great event. And we really appreciate your time on the program. Thank you so much, Mitch.
Vic, thank you so much. It's really been a delight being on and talking with you.
You've been listening to The Book Nook on WYSO. For The Book Nook, I'm Vic McCunis. And what a pleasure it was to talk to Mitchell Zuckoff about that amazing book and the plane crash that happened on Mother's Day, 1945. A very different book next week. We'll be talking to Christopher Buckley. He's written a humorous novel with a very provocative title. It's called They Eat Puppies, Don't They? In the Book Nook. The Book Nook is recorded at Soundspace in Yellow Springs and engineered by Chris Hertzler.